When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role, like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/murder, M-U-R-D-E-R. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Denville in the 1950s was an idyllic place to live, yet a dark chapter in the era's history has remained uncovered. During the summer of 1953, a wealthy traveler with a secret rap sheet as a convicted sex offender arrived in town to continue his misdeeds. A group of 13 local boys ranging in age from 14 to 22 took it upon themselves to teach the man a lesson and drive him out of town. What resulted was his brutal death and the largest number of people ever indicted for murder in the nation at the time. The harrowing trial and its aftermath revealed a town forced to grapple with how to protect its youth and come to terms with the gruesome incident. Local historian Peter Zablocki covers the crime and a small town's path to redemption. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Denville 13, Murder, Redemption, and Forgiveness in Small Town, New Jersey, with my special guest, historian and author Peter Zablocki. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview. Peter Zablocki.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Let's start off right away with this incredible book. When did you first discover the story of the Denville 13? Tell us how this came about.
So I called it the accidental book. I actually set out to write a book and collect stories of local population of my town of Denville. where I serve on the board of the Denville Historical Society. And I was trying to interview a lot of elderly folks from World War II times about essentially their experiences in World War II. And as I started meeting with individuals that were in their 80s, 90s, oddly enough, Denville 13, the murder of Denville 13, no one's ever heard of it. I mean, to the extent that it was buried so much that I have people coming out to me since the book's publication. They're like, I've lived here my whole life. How did I not know? However, as I was interviewing these elderly folks, they basically, at the end of each interview, a lot of them were like, hey, you know, there was this murder that happened in 1950s, but no one talks about it. And at first, I kind of dismissed it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's great, but let's talk about, you know, rationing in 1943. But then it started to come up more and more and more, to the extent that, ironically and like weirdly enough, a few individuals actually asked me as I was recording this interview, you know, is your camera off? And I'm like, yeah, it's off. We're done now. Thank you for the interview. And, you know, at that point, they were like, well, you know, there's this murder. And I'm like, okay, now I'm curious enough. And that is really how it started. And the name Denville 13 was thrown around by these individuals, you know, by these 80, 90-year-old ladies and gentlemen. They were like, you know, is it Denville 13? But when I Googled it, there was nothing. And, you know, I thought, you know, 21st century, if you Google something, if it doesn't exist on Google, it doesn't exist. Since my book's publication, now like one article from New York Times pops up. Because I uncovered a lot of those things, there's some keywords they could probably search for now. And there's a little bit more information on the web on this, but still nowhere near as much as for anything else, really. Because when I started looking into this, I couldn't find it. I mean, this was... I'm like, where does one look for this? And I started with murder in Denville, 1950, 51, 52. I went through every year and nothing popped up. And that's kind of when I started really digging into the newspaper. So I know Denville had a newspaper of its own. It was called the Denville Herald, and it published for over 20 years. So the library has a PDF file of the entire 20-year run. So that was my first starting point. And I went in, and the PDF file is scanned in such a bad way that, you know, the search function, the control F function, it doesn't really work well. So I'm literally scanning through every possible issue in 1950s. And oddly enough, I realized that the entire decade is full, but it's missing three pages of the first September issue, September 3rd of 1953. And I found that really odd that we would have every single issue, but missing three pages. You know, the first two pages are gone. So that kind of got me thinking of like, all right, September-ish, 1953, and that became my starting point. So then I started looking at other newspapers in the area, I mean, all the towns around. Basically, there was like four different towns around that had local newspapers in the 50s. And I was looking for September issues, no mention of this. However, I spoke to a member of the Historical Society, an older member of the Historical Society, and he said, you know, there's this folder that's somewhere upstairs. And one of these the historians in the town of Denville in 1970s collected this scrapbook of some stuff. And I think there's something in there about this murder, but, you know, no one ever talked about it. It's kind of hidden somewhere in the attic. So I went in the attic and I started looking for that folder. And meanwhile, I also realized that in our historical society in town, we have the microfilm of every Denville Herald that was photographed in 1970s as well. So I powered up the microfilm machine and I went through it all. And this time around, not only was just the three pages missing of that first September issue, but that entire September issue was never photographed in 1970s. So now I'm like, all right, someone is clearly, deliberately trying to hide this event. Meanwhile, I still don't really know what the event's about. I just know it was Denville 13. I assumed it was 13 people, not much past that. Then we went into these crates. We have these crates at the museum that are actually, someone meticulously collected every Denville Herald newspaper and put them in crates based on the year. So I'm like, you know what? This is it. Like, I'm going to have the real hard copy. Yeah. And I started looking through it, right? And I get to that 53 crate, and I'm like going through just the crawl space. And I pull it all out, and I'm in August. I'm excited, and boom, no first September issue. I'm like, this is crazy. So I started doing research and realized that Denville published 1,000 copies of each of their issue. Therefore, to this day, by the way, I have not found that copy of that issue. It's gone. So someone somewhere hid 1,000 copies of this issue. Meanwhile, wow. I did finally find this folder, this scrapbook by this historian in the town in the 1970s that kind of did this on his own. And I found a couple clippings. And the clippings I found, I finally figured it out based on the clippings. You know, this deals with teenagers. This deals with a really young population of kids. And this is the largest indictment for a single murder in all of American history. And I'm like, whoa, this is big. But then I still had no idea what newspapers those clippings came from, because the way this historian did it, he kind of just cut them out and, you know, scotch taped them. This is like 1970, you know? So I went back to the drawing board. I wound up contacting the Morris County Historical Society and the Morris County Museum. So Morristown is the bigger city. It's kind of like a quasi, I would say, capital of my county, where Denville is located.
Right.
And they're like, well, we have the Daily Record, which has been around, you know, for like 100 years, and we have all the hard copies. It's not digitized, so you would have to come see it. But it's COVID, and you know, COVID had just started, and I'm like, all right.
Right.
So a nice gentleman was like, you know what, I got nothing to do here anyway. It's COVID. No one's coming in. What do you need? I'll scan it for you. So I'm like, well, I just need a couple issues for probably September. And he scanned them over, sent them over to me, and he was just like, wow. And then I found I found those articles that kind of uncovered his story when it happened in 1953. And they were actually published front page news for like 2 weeks straight in this one particular newspaper in the capital of the county. But even those copies, I could not find anywhere but the Historical Society. They're not on the internet. They don't exist. And that kind of, now I saw the story and I was piecing it together here by, you know, little by little. I was still doing interviews with the elderly people based on World War II book, but I kind of paused the World War II book. And now I kind of started asking questions about this. And a lot of them were kind of reluctant to talk about it. And they're like, oh, we don't talk about it. Someone told me that, you know, I once dated a girl and she was a daughter of one of the 13, and my mom said I couldn't date her. So I'd rather not talk about it. You know, these are like older folks. And I'm like, okay. So then after I pieced it enough from the newspapers, I said to myself, you know, like, there's got to be more to the story. So as one of the town historians, I reached out to the prosecutor's office in the county, and I asked if this file exists for this murder through the OPRA, you know, Open Public Relations Act. And they're like, it does exist, but it's so old. It's in a box. It's off-site. Like, we don't know where it is. No one's accessed this since 53, but we could try to find it for you. I'm like, okay. And I kind of just let it go and went back to my World War II research. And then I received the file. They actually scanned it for me with autopsy reports, pictures, names, mugshots. I mean, everything. And that's when I'm like, okay, I can't just put this to the side. Like, I have to do something with this. And I started writing and just researching and piecing it together. And I said it's an accidental book because it was never really meant to be a book. I finished the entire manuscript. I put it in a three-ring binder. I brought it to the museum in Denville. I put it amongst the other binders of stories, and I just, like, walked away from it. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm done. And then members of the Historical Society, we had a meeting, and they're like, Pete, you should probably, like, look into it. Like, this story needs to be told. And I was kind of reluctant, mainly because I live in a town. I have two young kids that live in a town, and this is a very touchy topic that was clearly meticulously hidden for, you know, 70 years, odd years. And at that time, I was not yet able to locate all of the members of the 13. Since then, I have located all of them. But at the time, I wasn't sure, like, what if I know their grandkids or my kids are best friends with their grand-grandkids? It was kind of like this, I don't know. But the more I thought about it, and I feel like the way I wrote the book, ultimately, is like I felt like there really was a story that I put it in context. And once I put it in as a historian, I thought of it, why would something like this happen? And also, why would something like this be hidden for 70 years? And then I felt like this really was, at the end of the day, history. And this was, you know, like I tell my students, I'm a high school history teacher during the day. And I tell my students all the time that, you know, if I teach history right, I'm going to offend somebody at some point this year because history is offensive. And I kind of stuck with that and decided, oh, you know what, let's turn this into a manuscript and send it out. And I did, and I got interest from publishers right away, actually within like days. And, you know, I picked History Press, Arcadia Publishing, and now we're having this conversation.
Very interesting.
Now, as you write in the book, you give us a background because, like I had mentioned in before we spoke on the program here, is that we've got to give the historical, and you do give the historical background of what Denville and America was like in 1953. And in fact, with some of the research you've done as a historian, you know that from 1943 there was talk about juvenile delinquency. So tell us about what America and this little place of 6,000 population, Denville, was doing. What was the situation in Denville regarding juveniles and juvenile delinquency? What did the people of that community in America, what were their concerns?
Yep, so very similar. I feel like Denville is very much like a microcosm of just suburbia America, 1940s, 1950s. And what ultimately happened in 1940s, and I got this a lot from firsthand accounts because of interviewing people that lived here at the time, like most America, when World War II started, everyone seemed to pitch in. And while the male population oftentimes was drafted and went to fight in the war, the female population really did enter the workforce. And, you know, we study this in textbooks and we see this in documentaries, but just listening from the real perspective, looking at letters from real people and diary entries and speaking to people that were alive during the time, both parents entered the workforce. And all these parents worked in war-related industries. Nearby Denville, there was actually a Picatinny Arsenal, which was supplying the military during World War II, and it hired a lot of local Denville people, you know, female as well as male. There was also a radio airfield nearby Denville, like a mile outside of Denville, that was making radios and transistors for World War II. There was so much war work that ultimately you had parents, for the first time, especially following the Depression, where there was this pinch, there's not enough money, 1930s were kind of tough. 1940s, all of a sudden, there's an opportunity to go to work, and people jump on that opportunity. And unfortunately, what starts to happen is, as I started going back in newspapers into 1940s, I started reading about this juvenile delinquency problem, which was not just in Denville, but it really was a national issue, but very much for the same reasons. And the reason was that both parents went to work, and the kids were kind of left unattended. Now, by kids, I actually read accounts of, I mean, like 4 or 5-year-olds left home alone, you know, for 5 hours at a time. And I thought to myself, you know, 5-year-olds, I mean, how do you leave a 5-year-old for 6 hours? But they did, I guess, different times. However, the juvenile delinquency problem that started in the 40s, Denville actually held these community meetings. First time they held these community meetings in a community church was in the 40s, because there was a juvenile delinquency problem that dealt with kids that were under the age of 10. And that's what shocked the community. It's like, there was an 8-year-old that stole someone's gun and basically just ran around town sort of shooting at windows. He was caught. He had just turned 8 years old. And think of my 8-year-old, he can't even tie his shoes right. You know, like there's, a discrepancy here. You know, and that was the issue. Like, what's going on? And even then, they were able to pinpoint that. They were very quick to attack the parents. You know, and when you listen and you look at those statements from the 40s, they're saying, well, everyone's too busy trying to get a job and make a buck. And everyone's leaving these kids alone to kind of raise themselves. And that same premise kind of continues from the 40s onto the 50s. Now, in Denville's case, what's very interesting is that the Denville juvenile problem dealt with kids that were like 8 years old. And when the case of Denville 13, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, comes into play, you know, 10 years later or 8 years later, they're not necessarily different kids. They're the same generation kids. They simply grew up, and now they're 17 and 18, as opposed to being 8 years old. So it's not like the juvenile delinquency problem changed in the sense that it became different. It was the same problem. It's just that the generation of these kids that were left alone grew up to continuously also be left alone.
Right.
And I kind of felt like, overall speaking, I think this is kind of shows across the nation very similar trends. Yep.
Right. So you have a city, a town concerned with the attitude of young people and too much time on their hands, and there's all kinds of conversations about why, what contributes to all of this, including sort of a breakdown of the family unit, and everything is discussed. You take us to Paul's Diner, August 30th, 1953, about 2:30 a.m. in Mountain Lakes, which must be near Denville. And
it is. It's still there, by the way. You could still go get yourself a cheesesteak there if you want.
Now, this August 30th is just the day before school is supposed to be back in. So tell us about who are at this Paul's Diner, according to witnesses, at 2:30 a.m.
So at 2:30 a.m., according to witnesses, a group of four boys come into a diner. They look very agitated. It is late. They're technically starting school the next day, so it's like the last day of the summer. And they kind of seem out of place, but they get the booth. We don't really know what they ordered, per se, but we know they didn't stay long. We know that they stayed in this one particular booth, and they kept on looking around as if they were kind of scared to be there. The kids range. Youngest one was 14. The oldest boy was 22. The other two that were present were 18 and 17. So mostly teenagers, one person that was not a teenager. In fact, out of the 13 from the Denville 13, only one is not a teenager, and that's this 22-year-old. And they don't stay long. However, what happens is as they leave, they decide to leave after a little bit, and apparently out of one of these boys' back pockets, pocket falls out a wallet. And the wallet kind of gets, like I would say, gets nudged in between the cushion or your back cushion and your seat cushion in that booth. And that wallet belonged to a particular man. His name was Ross, was his first name. And it was an out-of-state license. And this is the person who we later find out is or was murdered a couple hours before that event happens.
Right.
So
now you talk about these boys in this soda shop here, and they have some drinks and then they leave. And you also then take us back to August 29th at 6:30 p.m. So you take us back a little ways in time to Rockaway River Beach. Tell us about the four young boys and what's happening at this river.
So what essentially happens here is there's a group of boys. They always hang out in this one particular soda shop in town. There's actually two soda shops in town, and the initial newspaper reports half the name of them wrong. Ironically, I spoke to somebody since then, and that person said to me, well, the Goody Two Shoes hang out with that one. We hung out with this one. Ironically, which is kind of an interesting story in itself. These boys have noticed this one particular man that drove into town that summer. Apparently he was, so this is end of summer, but he kind of started earlier in the summer, which is why some people had issues with the police that this was not picked up earlier. But this man drives in with a convertible car. It is a Hudson convertible. It is meticulous, very wealthy car. The person is in his early 30s. He dressed really well. He spends money lavishly. And he's kind of hanging out in all the hangout spots where all these teens hang out, including these soda shops, as well as this one particular beach. Denville as a town has a few lakes. It's pretty much a lake community. But for those people that did not belong to the lake communities, there was this one particular beach that was on a river, on the Rockaway River. And also a big hangout spot for kids that kind of felt like they didn't belong anywhere else. So this man also used to hang out there a lot. That particular morning of that day, the men walked into the soda shop. And apparently, based on witnesses, he started hitting on a young boy. The young boy in question was about 11 years old. After the man leaves, the four boys that witnessed this basically decide that they're going to drive him out of town. That is their ultimate goal. And they're sitting there over soda.
This man that they had saw and believed that had molested their one of their friends.
Friends, yep.
So what was their plan that they hatched at that time?
So the initial plan they hatched was they were going to get more kids involved in this. And that's kind of how it starts to grow to the number 13. And what happens is They said they're going to bait this man. They know he's going to show up at the other soda shop that same day. So they basically plant two kids that are 14 years old at the soda shop, and they basically try to get these two boys to bait him to hang out with them that night. The man is very, very kind of excited about this. He said, of course, absolutely. And what they decide to do, the plan is, they're trying to get him or lure him into one of the town's lover's lane. There was a Morris County canal that ran through Denville. By this time, 1950s, the canal itself is dry. However, the towpath next to the canal kind of snakes through the town. And it goes through these areas that are very wooded. And this is one of the spots where teenagers would kind of go and do their teenage things. So the ultimate goal is to get this man somehow with these two 14-year-old boys or so to this particular spot. And the goal is that if they get him to that spot, they could catch him in the act, one, two, beat him up, and three, kind of chase him out of town. That's the ultimate goal. And the plan is that they're going to have three cars. By this time, there's actually, by mid-afternoon, there's 12 kids involved in this entire plan. And I'll explain why only 12 in a second. But you have these 12 boys that are ready for this. They're divided into essentially two cars. Some of the boys load up to one car, drive to this lover's lane, which is in this, think, imagine like a dirt path in deep woods. And they drive down this towpath. They reverse their car in, shut the lights off, and they're going to wait there until the other boys will bait this man onto this lover's lane. Now, when this happens, there's another car full of these, the rest of the boys, I guess. And their job will be to follow this man and the boys that are baiting him to kind of make sure, there's no cell phones yet, but they kind of want to make sure they don't lose him. Right. And the plan stays. The plan is always to get him to that lover's lane. Well, the man suggests, the one idea was to maybe get him to the beach first to see if he does anything on the beach. And the man kind of suggests himself, like, yeah, let's go to the beach. When the plan is set into motion, the one car full of teenagers already goes to the lover's lane. It waits there in the dark. The man himself actually winds up getting together with three boys, not just two. Two are 14, one is 17. And he does suggest to go to the beach first, so they go to the beach. He doesn't know or realize that he's actually being followed by this other car, also full of teenagers. Now, after the beach, the plan was to tell him to just kind of, it was getting dark already, and they're like, let's get him to go to this lover's lane. However, that doesn't happen. So as opposed to making a turn in one direction, the man makes a turn in a different direction with these three boys inside his car, and he takes them to a local bar in a town over. While this is happening, you still have the one car full of boys waiting in the dark, kind of getting a little freaked out, like, where are they, what's going on? Meanwhile, the other car follows them to the bar. While at the bar, they stay at the bar for actually a few hours. And this 30-something-odd-year-old man proceeds to get these two 14-year-olds and 17-year-old drunk. He keeps on buying them drinks, spending money lavishly. Meanwhile, there's a car waiting in the parking lot, and these kids are like, what's going on in that bar? We need to know what's going on. Well, lucky for them, one of the three boys runs out to their car and says, all right, he's buying us drinks. I think everything in plan is still there. He wants to go to Lover's Lane. We'll go there. We'll get there. The boys are like, fine, we'll wait here until everything is good to go. Finally, after hours of sitting in this bar, half of the kids sitting in one area in the woods, not knowing what's going on, the other half sitting in this car in the parking lot, really kind of waiting for the inevitable, the man gets out. He actually allows one of these boys to drive his car while he gets in the back of the car with both of these 14-year-old boys. So he's in the back with 14-year-old boys, and there's 17-year-old boys driving. And now the plan is set into motion. They drive, they go across town. Now, while this is happening, the other car is following them, the car with the rest of the boys. Total now is 12. And this is where the 13th boy comes into play, which I thought was kind of a very ironic story. It's a very sad story. While this boy that's 17 is driving to Lover's Lane, the car following behind them is driving through the town of Denville. And Denville's, which is on the cover of my book, it was very known at the time to have this movie theater. And a particular boy walks out of the movie theater. It just happens to walk out. It's really late. It's after midnight. And he sees a car full of teenagers drive by. He knows some of them. He flags them down and basically asks them, can I get a ride home? And they're like, sure, hop in the car. We got to take care of something first. He's like, what do we got to do? Like, we got to run this guy out of town. And he's like, yeah, whatever. Just take me home. So he becomes the 13th boy. Now, right. While this is happening, the cars continue. The man with the three boys, the car pulls into Lover's Lane, into this dirt path into the woods. As he pulls in there, there's actually another car with a young couple, boy and a girl, that also try to go to this Lover's Lane. But there was this unwritten rule that if you see a car there, you just keep on going because it's taken. So this is important because that means that we know the exact time on the scene when this man got there that ultimately is the victim. So he pulls in. While he pulls in, there's boys hidden in front of him, well ahead of him. He doesn't see them in the car. The other car pulls in behind him, lights off. The man stays in the car with one 14-year-old boy. The other 14-year-old boy and a 17-year-old boy exit the vehicle. While they exit the vehicle, the boys from the front walk towards him. The boys in the back of the car that just arrived there, including the 13th boy, who quickly realizes what's going on. He does not stay for the beating. He actually runs home. The boy is really young. He's 15 years old. He's like, what is going on? So he doesn't stay there for the beating. He kind of gets brought in with the 13, but he's really not there. These boys approach this car. They essentially knock on the door. The windows are down, and although it's a convertible, the top was up. They knock on the door, and they basically peek in. They tell the men to get out. The man is visibly shaken up by this. He's kind of nervous that this is happening. He refuses to get out. They kind of prompt him to get out a couple more times. He continues to refuse. At that point, someone opens the door. They drag him out. And that's pretty much how this murder starts.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Peter, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, FabFitFun. My wife Lisa and I are looking forward to the warm weather this summer and outdoor activities like biking and going to the beach. FabFitFun has been a sponsor of True Murder for many years now. This season is different. FabFitFun is now the only subscription boxes that are 100% customizable. This great new perk is only available to annual members. Just another good reason to sign up for the yearly subscription. Discover great deals on top brands, up to 70% off. There are also flash sales on luxury items. Lisa is always excited to get another FabFitFun box. She tells everyone that some of the products in FabFitFun boxes are worth more than what members pay for in the entire box. Lisa has been relying on FabFitFun for the latest skin and body care products she's incorporated into her daily life. Order your summer box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the Mured Rapid Collagen Infusion and Lashes MD Eyelash Conditioner when you customize. And don't forget to use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Plus, for a limited time only, annual members will receive an extra gift valued at $125 with their purchases while supplies last. That's coupon code MURDER21 for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. That's coupon code MURDER21 for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Peter, we are at the point where 12 of these boys, 13 of these boys, one of the boys leaves and doesn't witness the actual assault or doesn't witness the extent of it, let's say that, and goes home and tells his parents.
Yep.
Now, this was a pop bottle, a soda pop bottle.
It was pop bottle, that he was hit with. So ultimately what starts to happen is they start pushing him around. There's a shoving match going back and forth. Most of the boys, if you could imagine this, it is dark. Actually, it's actually quite dark, very dark, really. The car's lights were turned off. for a reason, obviously. At one point, someone supposedly did go back and turn the lights on the car that was driven by the group of boys that pulled in behind the victim's car. Mm-hmm. So there's, imagine just illumination probably up to like your, your belt area. It's fairly dark. And they're pushing this guy around. Most of these boys are standing on the outskirts. They're kind of standing around and they're like watching the situation. There's yelling, cursing, so on and so forth. Until one of the boys says, "Hey, give me that soda bottle." Grabs the soda bottle and he starts hitting him, the victim, with a soda bottle. This continues until another boy jumps in and he starts hitting him as well. It gets to the point that the man falls to the ground. And once there's these two boys that are hitting him, a third boy runs up and actually grabs the boy that's doing the hitting at this point and pulls him off this man and says, "Enough, enough." So they pull him off. Meanwhile, so we probably have only three kids that are involved. There's 12 there, so imagine 9 standing on the side. And now this man is unconscious. Someone says, "Hey, go through his wallet, go through his wallet." So someone, another boy, picks up, goes through the man's wallet. The man is still unconscious. It is later stated in the police reports that the boys felt that he was still alive, at this point at least, when they were going searching through his wallet and so on and so forth. However, it quickly becomes evident to them that the man is unconscious to the extent that he's dead. And that's kind of when the panic sets in, because they didn't anticipate killing anybody at that moment. You know, the point was to scare this man, at least that was the original intent or impetus that night. However, at this point, you could see that most of these kids are kind of like, "Oh my God, like what just happened? What do we do now?" And a lot of them, a few of them actually started walking home, never making it home. Some people slept outside. Some people slept in cars, park benches. Some made it home. Everyone kind of just dispersed, and they left the body laying right next to this car. The initial group of boys who planned this whole thing that morning at the soda shop, out of these four boys, you have the oldest one, that's 22, which is the one that starts the hitting with the bottle. He's the one that initiates the hard hitting. You have another boy who does the hitting as well. And then in that group of four is also a 14-year-old who is later proven to be one of the main ringleaders, ironically, of this group. And he was the youngest of this group. And they are the ones that kind of freak out and wind up going to a local diner, which is where I kind of started my story when I started telling the story. Mm-hmm. Because they do a couple things that really lead to them being caught. The first one is the fact that they leave the wallet of the victim, as I mentioned, accidentally in that booth, which sure. ties them directly to this murder. The other thing, while they're at this, you know, it's getting kind of late, it's getting kind of early, rather. So the sky is getting a little brighter. And they hatch this plan, like, maybe we'll make this look like an accident of some sorts. So they decide that they're going to go back to the scene of the crime. And they drive back to the scene of the crime, and it's really early in the morning. And as they drive in to get there, to this Lover's Lane, you have to go into this dead-end street. So imagine driving down this dead-end street. No one... dead end, unless you live there, and you know, why would you be there at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m.? Well, when they drive down there, they realize that there is already someone there next to the car. They quickly turn around, speed away. However, again, the car is identified, and it places them on the scene. So it's not just the wallet, but it's also the fact that they were seen at the scene that morning. The person that discovers this body... there's a lady that goes out for a walk, presumably with a dog, and she sees a car parked in Lover's Lane. Again, this is something that teenagers used to do all the time. So the way that the body is laying down, if you look at the cover of my book, on the back cover of the book, is the picture of the car itself, and the door of the car is open, and right underneath that door, if you look on the cover, it's a redacted picture. You see like this dark blob, and that's because you would see the body laying right next to that open door. The way that this lady walks towards the car, she walks towards it from the other direction on the right side. So she doesn't really see the body. She kind of gets close enough, and she's like, I don't know what's going on there. She runs back home and gets a family member to come out there, and that's when he comes out and he discovers this body. Police is notified right away. They get on the scene. And more or less, the way that I gathered it from the police files, but also from newspapers, they had 13 kids in custody within 24 hours. This was quick.
Incredible.
You know, this wasn't like trying to find them. They got them. Within a week, you have, and this would never happen in today's world, within a week, you have a front page of a newspaper has all of their mugshots, including, and most of these kids are 14 years old. There's 14, there's 15, there's a couple 16s, but, you know, these are young kids. And you have all of their mugshots, front page of the newspaper, with a big headline saying, all 13 face murder charge.
Right.
In the articles that were published, you have their street addresses, their parents' full names. You have, you also have their parents' addresses of work. I mean, things that would never happen for minors in today's day and age. This is shocking. Apparently, what I gather is that the town literally just stops. You know, it is at this point the largest indictment for a single murder in all of American history. And what makes it so much more shocking is that all but one of these perpetrators are teenagers. And that's when the shock factor hits. It's like, wait, what just happened? Which I think also contributes to why this is hidden so much for the next 70 years.
But you talk about
kind of the gist.
You talk about Chief Harry B. Jenkins being instrumental, being a big figure in town, an important figure, and also very concerned about what's going on in the city in the last 10 years with this juvenile delinquency rise.
Mm-hmm.
He is instrumental in being able to get the information from these people. You write, again, another thing that would never happen today is all of the parents are there present when they make statements to the police. So there is a kind of cooperation that would never exist today, wouldn't it?
Yep, absolutely. And Chief Jenkins, everyone that I spoke about that knew Chief Jenkins, they said he was a very tall man and he had a certain presence. You know, he was the guy when you were 5 years old that would help you cross the street in front of the school. Everyone knew him for that. And he was also the guy that if you got in trouble, he didn't put you in jail. He went to talk to your mom and dad. You know, he was the guy that would show up at your doorstep and kind of left it in the parents' hands, be like, all right, listen, this is what Jimmy did today. And you had the respect for Chief Jenkins. Like, he was there. It definitely was this, it almost looked like, you know, like the Andy Griffith Show kind of thing. You know, you had that vibe in this small town America. So Chief Jenkins was, because of the relationships that he formed with the parents of these kids, you know, this kind of, it wasn't like, I felt at least when I was reading into it, that this was a very like sad time when he brought them all in. I actually got firsthand accounts when these kids got arrested. I mean, one particular Denville 13 kid, he showed up at door, rang the doorbell, and basically said to the, you know, mom and dad, you know, we got to take this person to the police station. He did something really bad. And the parents were like, all right, that's what you think that has to happen. You know, Chief Jenkins, that's what has to happen. Like, that was it. They just kind of let him, you know, because there's that trust. And he felt very much that the blame was going to go on him because of the fact that this man, it's almost like a story of vigilante justice. I mean, that's ultimately what this is. You have these, and I think that's the vibe I got from doing the interviews and reading into it, is that these 13 kids took it upon themselves to clear their town of what they perceived to be a threat. Now, their intent was not murder. However, that is ultimately the end result, which is why we're talking about this 7 years later. But Chief Jenkins had this feeling that this man was in town for a couple months, and he felt that people were going to blame him for the fact that this was allowed to get this far. But as I mentioned in the book, very similar to many of these small American towns, Chief Jenkins was one of like three police officers in the whole town. And the police officers at the time, one was part-time, the other two, including Chief Jenkins, were not. But there's so many different responsibilities of checking in on businesses. In 1950s, I had to drive down Main Street and make sure all businesses were locked. You would think that an owner would do that, but the police did that. There were so many things that they were responsible for, this group of like 2.5 men that, you know, 3.5 men that, you know, he kind of felt like he did his best by trying to establish a sense of community where all the parents were also the police. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the potential charges that can be had. You said that the announcement in the papers were that they would all be charged for murder.
Yeah.
But you talk about the existing law at that time in terms of motive. If a motive like robbery were to be found in this case, mm-hmm. tell us about what that
so
situation
might create.
So
the main question
create.
Here was. Yep, the main question was, once these guys were put on trial, a lot of their cases were dismissed due to the fact of their age. So a lot of these boys were directed to juvenile court. However, their cases were still heard and made public. The big key was intent. If this person was killed without theft, the judge assumed at the time or stated at the time, then there was a possibility of manslaughter. That, you know, there was no intent of trying to get something from this person. Potentially, that might have been an accidental killing. However, if they could prove that there was intent to steal something or take something from that person, right away the theft aspect would turn this into essentially a first-degree murder. And then there was, like, different levels of that intent of taking something. You know, like, did they set out to take it or did they take it afterwards? And in this case, the wallet is what comes back to haunt these boys. Because by taking that wallet, that becomes a key because it's like, well, was it intended? Was it not intended? And it kept on being brought up in court. Who took the wallet? Who looked in the wallet? Who looked into this? You know, it's very specific. Like, what was taken? Who knew about this? Was this premeditated in any way, shape, or form? And ultimately, once this case did get to court, all these boys face charges, and as I mentioned before, you know, when you look at the prosecutor's office, and I spoke about that in one of the chapters, one of the main boys that kind of orchestrated this whole thing, that said, hey, we're going to get someone to bait this guy, we're going to get him to Lover's Lane, we'll beat him up, we'll do what we have to do, he was 14 years old, and he was unable to be tried in regular court. However, he was in regular court to listen to the hearing. And the judge made sure he was very clear to him that what you did is not excused by your age. Like, you know, what you did was bad, and you need to live with that for the rest of your life. He tried to really kind of instill this in his boys that you guys have some form of guilt to live with for the rest of your life. Ultimately, as the case goes on in court, what is determined, and I kind of got this vibe that I think it dealt a lot with the situation of the age of these kids, the person that winds up going to jail for this is the only non-teenager, the one that starts off with the soda bottle and the one that starts the actual hitting. And that's actually George Compo. I didn't use his last name in the book, but since he was an adult, I don't have a problem using it. His name is George Compo. And George Compo is the only person that actually receives jail time out of these 13 kids. Now, if you study and look into the history of George Compo, which is an interesting story in itself, George Compo was born in 1931. If you Google, just type into Google, Compo, 1931, New Jersey. I was trying to, you know, kind of pinpoint and find out what happened to all these guys. What pops up is a different Compo. And this isn't a story, this is a story in itself. George Compo's dad was arrested the year that George Compo his mom was pregnant with him. So before he was born, his mom was pregnant with him. His father's arrested for multiple murders in the city of Newark in New Jersey. He is a gang member, a young 20-year-old gang member that is arrested for multiple murders. The year that George is born, when he's an infant, his father is electrocuted by the state of New Jersey for committing those murders. And 22 years later, his son goes to jail for committing murder. It is an interesting story in itself. Out of the other 12 boys, the other one that did the hitting was actually given a choice to enlist in the military, and he takes that. He picks that choice. He enlists in the military, so he does not serve any time. However, we have to mention the Korean War is going on during this time, and the boy that enlists in the military winds up dying in a freak airplane accident while in the military only a few short months later. As for the remainder of the boys, and this is kind of where the story gets interesting, because the remainder of the boys, the 14-year-old winds up going to a juvenile kind of delinquency center, and he's not around for a couple of years. So he goes away. Another boy goes away for a year or so, but for the most part, so out of that, you're looking at, that leaves us with 9 kids. They all go back to school. By Thanksgiving, Christmas time, because that's pretty much how long this drags in. So it drags from last day of summer to about end of Thanksgiving, about Thanksgiving time. After that, they all return to school. And everyone kind of knows what happened, but the town chooses to just let them be. And they do. They very much just let them be. Like I said, it was 1,000 newspapers printed that September. I cannot find a single one today. Having multiple opportunities to find it, I just can't find it. No one talks about this case. When people, talked about it, even to me, it was very quiet. I have people that live here since then that moved into town in late 50s or the 60s, and they're like, we've never heard of this. And those that did live during this time, some were still reluctant to talk about it, like, oh, we don't talk about that. It was a very unfortunate thing. So when I published this book, I was very curious what happened to these guys. And after tracing all of these families and the 13 boys, none of them actually are still alive. So by the time I published this book a couple months ago, the last person had passed away about 3 months before that. So they passed away last year. And therefore, none of them were ever aware of the fact that I ever wrote this story, because this story was non-existent. I mean, it supposedly never existed.
You write about the judge in this case did a lot of questioning, despite these pleas, to find out that many of these boys were just there for the ride. And so he wanted to determine their culpability in this. And so he asked them and their attorneys to furnish that information. Part of this, though, it seems, is that this victim had a police record. He was a sex offender. Tell us about the record of the victim and what you think of its role in sort of the leniency afforded these youths despite the murder.
So a big role, as you mentioned, a huge role, I think, in the fact that except for one boy going to prison, everybody else being set free, I think this is very closely tied to who this person that they wind up murdering really was. So Ross, who was in his 30s, was a convicted sex offender. He actually spent time in a maximum security prison a few years prior to this event for having sex with boys that are ranging between the age of 11 and 13. So it wasn't even the fact that he was gay, which in itself in 1950s was something that was extremely frowned upon and almost out of this maximum security prison. This man gets engaged to a woman, which based on what I was looking at for 1950s and homosexuality, a lot of people that were homosexual, still society's expectations definitely took precedence. And a lot of them did settle down, have families, and almost live like two different lives. In this case, it wasn't just the fact that this man was gay. It was the fact that he had been convicted of having sex with boys that were extremely young and underage. He spent a few years in prison, as I mentioned. When he leaves prison, that is when he essentially decides to move to Denville. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he lives in a town next to Denville, but he hangs out in Denville an awful lot. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that there is so many beaches in Denville. Denville is very much viewed as like a summer, fun summer community suburb. And he moves there during summer. He also, during this time, actually enlists to become a priest. He begins to study to become a priest while this is all happening. So when all that is uncovered, specifically in newspapers, once this case is happening. So these boys are all arrested. They're arrested in September. They are actually kept in a county jail for approximately 2-3 months by the time this is all done and over with. Their family members could only visit them on Saturdays, and they go and see them, you know, so sisters, brothers, parents, they go and see these boys ultimately through a jail cell for a couple hours. Meanwhile, the newspapers are kind of very blunt about the fact that this person that these boys potentially accidentally killed or murdered was not a good person, you know, that he was here to ultimately continue his misdeeds. That was the story, the narrative that was presented in the town, which, as you mentioned, Dan, I think plays a huge role in ultimately the fact that this judge kind of looks at these boys and says, you know, it's almost, there's this morality question here. I mean, ultimately, this man could have done a lot of harm to some people, but at the same time, it's never okay to murder anybody. So there's this big morality question here. You know, it's like these boys definitely took matters in their own hands. And I think that's the vibe that I got as well from interviewing people was this, well, these boys try to protect their town. It just got out of hand. And ultimately, the towns, in return, was going to protect them, which is why Denville 13 disappears for 70 years.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, that the George C., the ringleader, exhibited a certain behavior at this hearing, unlike the other boys.
Yep.
What was that reaction?
So I've actually spoken to some people that were friends with these Denville 13 guys that grew up there and it was hung out at the same soda shop. And this, and I quote, I was basically told that George C. was like Biff from Back to the Future. He was the guy that felt like he was untouchable. He was the guy that would spit at people, the guy that would say inappropriate things to girls, the guy that had complete disregard for authority, and almost somebody that everybody else was afraid to say no to. I should also mention that he also had a criminal record out of these Denville 13. He had a criminal record as well. And what he does during this court hearing, because as I'm like reviewing these court documents, I'm thinking to myself, like, did they only pick him because he was the oldest? But then I kind of, you know, you start reading into it, and he was the first one to initiate the hitting itself. He was there to plan it. And during this hearing, while all these boys, for the most part, are crying and they're like, I cannot believe this is happening to me, he sits there with like a smirk on his face. And, you know, this vibe of almost like, well, I did the right thing. And he was not afraid. He was not afraid of, it's almost like I got the vibe of he welcomed the fact that he was going to be found as someone that's responsible for killing this person. That's just kind of the vibe I got from it.
You had a chance to talk to another person, Donald F., you write, and this is the person that ran away and told his parents that got just sucked into this thing, going to a movie theater. What did his daughter have to say?
Yeah, so I spoke to his daughter since then, and as well as his sister. And, you know, we kind of got talking about the fact that this was hidden almost directly after it happened. It's almost as if someone made this unofficial, unwritten decision to say, we're just never going to talk about this. The newspapers disappear, and it's just never mentioned. And when I spoke to his family, you know, this boy got kind of brought into this. His, you know, face is on the front page of a newspaper. His name is there, except he wasn't really there. He didn't plan it. He didn't even stay for the event. He was truly an accidental 13th boy, and how much it impacted his life going forward. And when I spoke to his family, they said that they almost wish that, as hard as it was for this book to come out right now, they almost wish that this was talked about 70 years ago. You know, it's almost as if, like, people were able to be open about it and discuss for what it was. And these were kids doing stupid things, and it got out of hand. And this idea that, you know, one rotten apple spoils a whole bunch. And when I spoke to a daughter and a sister of this boy, they said he lived his whole life in shame. Like he had to live a secret. And although I was unable to kind of confirm that from a lot of the other guys, because I haven't talked to their families, but I have a feeling that this is something that is concurrent with a lot of these men. This feeling of just guilt, like they lived with something that was, it's almost like they were part of a secret of a town and they couldn't talk about it. And they tell you, you know, psychologically and philosophically, and they tell you you should talk about your problems, right? These guys didn't. And from what they got from this family is that, I mean, it led to alcohol. You know, he was a great man, lived a really good life going forward, but he truly always, when you looked in his face, like he was carrying a big weight.
Yes, absolutely. In the end, with the Denville 13, the city, the town, again, covered up this and didn't want to talk about it. But the city went on to take some of the advice from those town hall meetings and towards juveniles and made some changes, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. So when I was coming up with the title for this book, you know, Denville 13 was definitely the title. I mean, that's what they were called. Murder definitely drives this story, but I felt like this was as much a story about redemption and forgiveness of a town and then just the murder. I feel like the murder started this. But in reality, after, as you mentioned, after this murder takes place, the town responds by holding these community meetings that they held during World War II. And now it's a decade later, and they bring in, I think it's really ahead of its time for 1950s suburbs, they bring in psychologists, child psychologists. They bring in teachers. They bring in community leaders, mayors, police. They bring students. You know, they're like, we want to hear from high school students. Well, what's going on here? They're almost like every possible outlet they could think of to try to come up with a plan of not just explaining how this happened, but to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again, that the boys would never be put in a situation where they would even be capable of or think that this is okay to do. And what ultimately they decide is that the town, suburbs at a time, as opposed to like a Levitt town-style suburban town where there's not much to do, it is decided that Denville should become a very family-oriented community. Within a year, you have almost 10 new playgrounds. You have a whole field directed. You know, now it's like the rage of every town having a field and soccer fields and baseball fields. Denville has all of that in the 50s. They open up a whole community, basically recreation park, multiple baseball fields, football field, soccer field. This is way ahead of its time. They create the police athletic league for both boys and girls within mere months of this event. Little League baseball, which at the time was only started a year prior and it went only up to, I think, the age of 9 or 10, they extended that for teenagers as well. The idea was to kind of make Denver very inclusive. Do you have parades that are all of a sudden kind of bringing together all these different community organizations? You have Santa Land, which is actually still around to this day, where if you can't afford to take your son or daughter to go take a picture with Santa in the mall, you go to Santa Land, and there's, you know, which is basically like a little area in Denver where Santa lives, and you could bring your son or daughter, and you don't need to pay anything. You just take a picture with Santa, and you could talk to Santa, and that's still going on today, and it started directly after this. It was this idea of let's turn this event and really try and strive to make Denver a very inclusive, family-oriented town. And ironically, that is what attracted me to move to this town and start a family here. I mean, I consider Denville to be my hometown, and it's a great, great town for kids, raising kids in.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the Denville 13 murder, redemption, and forgiveness in small town New Jersey. It's been fascinating. For those that might want to take a look, is there a website? I know this is a History Press release. Tell us about any place where they might take a look at this book further.
So technically, this book, you could get this book anywhere the books are sold. I mean, they sell them on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Target, and so on and so forth. I have, you can find me on Facebook. You could just type in Peter Zablocki, and you could find my author's page on Facebook. This is the History Press release. I also, if you want to read a little bit more about myself, I also have a podcast, nothing like your production by any means, but my best friend and I have a podcast. We're both history teachers, and it's called History Teachers Talking. So you can always find us at historyteacherstalkingpodcast.com, and I also have a link in there to information about this book, as that is kind of like my main social media platform at this point. But.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's been fascinating. The Denville 13, Murder, Redemption, and Forgiveness in Small Town, New Jersey. Thank you so much for making this call, especially under the circumstances. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. And good
thank
night.
You so thank much, you. And thank you for having me. Have a great night. Bye.
You too. Good night.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.